males, they must make themselves useful. Because a spider alone is vulnerable, always at the mercy of bullying from her larger kin, these maturing spiderlings tend to band together into peer groups formed from those who hatch from the same creche at around the same time. The bonds made between juveniles, who aid and rely upon one another, persist into adulthood. Unions of such peers form the base social unit in most spider settlements, and these peers then tend to found a creche between them, looking after one another's eggs, and so inadvertently perpetuating a continuity of heredity down the female line. The social bonds within such peer groups are strong. Even after the individuals have gone their separate ways and taken up their particular trades and specialities, all the larger peer groups maintain peer houses within the city, house here meaning a complex of silk-walled chambers. Males do not form such groups, for who would have any use for a large group of males? Instead, juvenile males do their best to attach themselves to the periphery of a female peer group, playing at flirting, running errands, paying in utility and amusement value for the scraps of food that might get thrown their way. Portia is vaguely aware that males fight each other, and that the lower, less desirable reaches of the city play host to countless little dramas between males struggling over food or status. She has very little interest in the subject. She is bitterly exhausted when she crawls through the entrance of her peer house, located at the lowest point of the series of bubble chambers in which her fellows dwell and meet. Another couple of rooms have been added since she was last here. Restructuring is no major chore for her kind. And for a moment she feels proud and happy that her peers are doing well, before her treacherous memory goads her with the thought of the ants' inexorable advance. Building more just means more to lose. Those of her peers who are currently in residence greet her warmly. Several of her closer friends are holding court there at the centre of a worshipful knot of younger females and fluttering, dancing males. Their dances are courtship rituals that they constantly, almost, but not quite, consummate. Other than menial labour, this is the place of a male in Portia's society. Adornment, decoration, simply to add value to the lives of females. The larger, more notable or more important a female is, the more males will dance attendance on her. Hence, having a crowd of uselessly elegant males around one is a status symbol. If Portia, the great warrior, were to stay still long enough, then she would attract her own entourage of hopeful parasites. Indeed, if she cast them off and refused their attentions, she would be diminishing herself in the eyes of her peers and her culture. And sometimes the courtship will proceed as far as mating, if the female feels sufficiently safe and prosperous to start work on a clutch of eggs. The act of courtship is consummated as a public ritual, where the hopeful males, in their moment of prominence, perform in front of a peer group, or even the whole city, before the female chooses her partner and accepts his package of sperm. She may then kill and eat him, which is thought to be a great honour for the victim, although even Portia suspects that the males do not quite see it that way. It is a mark of how far her species has come that this is the only openly acceptable time when killing a male is considered appropriate. It is, however, quite true that packs of females, especially younger ones, perhaps newly formed peer groups seeking to strengthen their bonds, will descend to the lower reaches of the city and engage in hunting males. The practice is covertly overlooked, girls will be girls after all, but overtly frowned upon. Killing a male, sanctioned or not, is a world apart from killing a beast. Even as the fang strikes, the killer and the slain know themselves to be part of a grander whole. The nanovirus speaks, each to each. Portia's culture is strung between base spider nature and the new empathy the nanovirus has inflicted upon them. There are more of her peers here than Portia had expected to see. One of her seniors is entering her time, and therefore must retire from society for a month or so. And her sisters are rallying round her to make the ordeal as painless as possible. Portia ascends to one of the inner chambers to witness the rite, because it will at least give the illusion that life here is proceeding according to age-old patterns, and so might continue in the same way for generations to come. She arrives just in time to see her ailing sister retreat into her cocoon. In ancient, primitive times, she would have been left alone in some high, safe spot, spinning her own retreat before retiring in lonely secrecy. Now, she has sisters to create her haven for her, and then keep her company, while she molts. Portia's kind must shed their skins in order to grow. When it is time for a large female to cast off her skin, when she feels it too tight at each joint, and with each breath of her abdomen, she retires to her peer house, to the company of those she trusts, and they spin her a cocoon that will support her expanded frame until her expanded skin has hardened again. As Portia watches, the retiring female begins the difficult, painful task of ridding herself of her skin, first flexing her abdomen until the shell cracks there, and then peeling herself from back to front. The process will take hours, and her sisters stroke the cocoon with messages of solidarity and support. They have all been through this. It must be difficult for males, who presumably undergo the ordeal alone, but then males are smaller and less sensitive, and Portia is honestly not sure how capable they are of finer levels of thought and feeling. A handful of her sisters notice Portia there and scurry over to talk. They listen with agitation to her news of seven trees, news that will be all over Great Nest by now, because males can never keep their feet still when they have something to say. Her fellows touch palps and try to tell her that what happened to seven trees cannot happen here. But nothing they say can remove those images from Portia's memory. The flames, the whole structure of a thriving settlement just withering in the heat, the reservoir fraying and splitting, its waters cascading down amid a rising current of steam, those who could not jump or glide far enough being overwhelmed by the roiling tide of ants to be dismembered while still alive. She performs a careful calculation based on her count of days and the elevation of the sun outside, and tells them that she is going to the temple. She badly needs peace of mind, and the messenger will be passing soon. "Go quickly. There will be many others seeking the same," one of her sisters advises her. Even without Portia's personal experience, the population of Great Nest is fast becoming aware that they face a threat seemingly without limit. All their centuries of culture and sophistication may become nothing but a fading memory in the minds of the stomatopod sea-dwellers. The temple at Great Nest is the city's highest point, a space without walls, strung between the extremity of the canopy above with an inward-sloping floor below. At its centre, on the apex of one of the city's original trees, is the crystal that Portia's own ancestress wrested from the ants, a deed that has since become legend. If Portia reaches inside herself, she can even touch that other Portia's understandings, a private retelling of the well-known story through the lens of first-hand experience. She arrives ahead of the messenger's appearance, but there is already barely room for her amongst the crouching multitude, thronged all the way up to the central trunk. Many have the look of refugees, those who escaped Seven Trees and other places. They are come here to find hope, because the material world outside seems to hold little of it. How Portia's people regard the messenger and its message is hard to say. Theirs is an alien mindset, trying to unravel the threads of a phenomenon they are equipped to analyse and yet not understand. They gaze up at the messenger in its fleet passage across the sky, and they see an entity that speaks to them in mathematical riddles that are aesthetically appealing to a species that has inherited geometry as the cornerstone of its civilization. They do not conceive of it as some celestial spider god that will reach down into their green world and save them from the ant tide. However, the message is. The messenger is. These are facts, and those facts are the doorway to an invisible, intangible world of the unknown. The true meaning of the message is that there is more than spider eyes can see or spider feet can feel. That is where hope lies, for there may yet be salvation hidden within that more. It inspires them to keep looking. The priestess has emerged to dance, her stylus hunting out the connection points on the crystal, as invisibly the messenger crosses the blue vault of the sky while broadcasting its constant message. Portia spins and knots, reciting the mantras of numbers to herself, watching the votary begin her elegant visual proofs, each step and every sweep of her palps speaking of the beauty of universal order, the reassurance that there is a logic to the world, extending beyond the mere chaos of the physical. But even here, there is a sense of change and threat. As Portia watches the dance, it seems to her that the priestess halts sometimes, just for a second, or even stumbles. Ripples of unease pass through the close-packed congregation, who spin all the harder, as if to cover over that slip. An inexperienced priestess, Portia reassures herself, but she feels dreadfully afraid deep within herself. Is the doom that threatens her people in the material world now being reflected in the heavens? Is there a variation in the eternal message? After the service finishes, and feeling more shaken than reassured, she finds a male in her way, frantically signalling his good intentions and that he bears a message for her. You are needed, the little creature tells her, coming close enough to brave her fangs in his insistence. Bianca asks for you. Bianca, this particular Bianca, is one of Portia's peer group, but not one that she has spoken with in a long time. No warrior, but instead one of the foremost scholars of Portia's people. Lead me, Portia directs. Chapter 3.5 Bearing a Flaming Sword. Holston and Lane had been left to their own limited devices for some time, constantly overseen by one or other of Scholes's people. Holston had been hoping to have more words with Nessel, on the basis that he might just be able to trade enough on his doctorate to gain some sort of cooperation from her, but she had been redeployed by her leader, perhaps for that exact reason. Instead, there had been a succession of taciturn men and women with guns, one of whom had bloodied Holston's lip just for opening his mouth. They had heard distant shots on occasion, but the anticipated crescendo never seemed to arrive, nor did the fighting recede entirely out of earshot. It seemed that neither Scholes nor Cast was willing to force the matter to any sort of conclusion.
"It's times like these," Holston started, speaking softly for Lane's benefit only.
She raised an eyebrow.
"Times like what, Mason? Being held hostage by lunatic mutineers who might kill us at any second? How many times like those have you heard exactly? Or is the world of academia more interesting than I thought?"
He shrugged.
"Well, on the basis that we were all under a death sentence on Earth, and then the last time we were working together, a mad computer person hybrid thing wanted to kill us for disturbing its monkeys, I think it's been times like these all the way, to be honest."
Her smile was faint, but it was there.
"I'm sorry I got you into this. Not half as sorry as I am."
At that point, Scholes burst in with a half-dozen followers crowding the hatch behind him. He shoved something into the hands of the guard that the man quickly donned. A mask. They were all putting on oxygen masks.
"Oh, fuck," Lane spat. "Cast's got control of the air vents."
From her tone, it was something that she had been anticipating for some time.
"Cut him loose!"
From behind the mask, Scholes's voice emerged with the tinny precision of his radio transmitter. Immediately, someone was bending over Holston, severing his restraints, hauling him to his feet.
"He's coming with us," Scholes snapped,
and now Holston could hear gunfire again, and more of it than before.
"What about her?"
A nod towards Lane.
"Shoot the bitch."
"Wait! Hold on!"
Holston got out, flinching as the gun swung back towards him.
"You need me, then you need her. She's the chief engineer, for life's sake. If you're going anywhere on a shuttle, if you're serious about going up against Kern, against that killer satellite, then you need her. Come on, she's key crew. That means she's the best engineer on the ship."
And, despite his words, when the gun swung back towards Lane,
"No, seriously, wait, I know you can force me to do whatever you want, but if you kill her, I'll fucking fight you to my last breath. I'll sabotage the shuttle. I don't know what I'll do, but I'll find something. Keep her alive, and I'll do everything you need, and everything I can think of, to keep you alive. To keep us all alive. Come on, it makes sense. Surely you can see it makes sense."
He could not see Scholes's expression, and for a moment the chief mutineer just stood there, statue still, but then he nodded once, and exceedingly grudgingly.
"Get them both masks," he snapped. "Get them up, re-secure their arms and bring them along. We're getting off this ship right now."
Outside in the corridor waited a dozen or so of Scholes's people, most of them also wearing masks. Holston looked from one set of visor-framed eyes to the next until he picked out Nessel, not quite a familiar face, but better than nothing at all. The rest of them, men and women both, were strangers.
"Shuttle bay, now!"
was Scholes's order, and then they set off, shoving Lane and Holston ahead of them. Holston had no idea about much of the Gilgamesh's layout, but Scholes and his party seemed to be taking a decidedly circuitous route to wherever they were going. The chief mutineer was constantly muttering, obviously in radio contact with his subordinates. Presumably there was some serious offensive by security going on, and certainly the pace quickened and quickened again. First to the shuttle bay wins? Then one of the mutineers stumbled and fell, leaving Holston wondering if he'd missed the sound of a shot. Nessel dropped to one knee beside him and began fiddling with his mask, and a moment later the man was stirring drunkenly, staggering to his feet with Scholes roundly cursing him.
"Since when did we have poison gas on the ship?"
the classicist demanded wildly. Again, the whole episode was assuming a dreamlike quality. Lane's voice sounded right in his ear. "Idiot. Just fucking with the air mix would do it. I guess these monkeys have been fighting for control of the air conditioning since they made their stupid stand, and now they've lost. This is a spaceship, remember? The atmosphere is whatever the machines say it should be."
"All right, all right," Holston managed to reply, as someone shoved him hard in the back to get him to pick up speed.
"What?" the man beside him demanded, shooting him a suspicious look. Holston realized that Lane's voice had not broadcast to the rest of them, only to him.
"I despair of you, old man," came her murmur. "These masks do have tongue controls, you realize. Of course you don't. And neither do these clowns. You have 4 tabs by your tongue. Second one selects comms menu, then third for private channel. Select 9. It'll show in your display."
It took him the best part of 10 minutes to get through that, slobbering over the controls and terrified that one false drool would turn his air supply off. In the end, it was only when their escorts halted abruptly for a furious discussion that he was able to work it out.
"How's this?"
"Clear enough," came Lane's dry response. "So, how fucked are we, eh?"
Was that seriously what you wanted to say?
"Look, Mason, they hate my guts. What I really want to say is that you should talk them into letting you go. Tell them you're a crap hostage, or that they don't need you, or something." He blinked, seeking out her eyes, but finding only the lamps reflecting in the plastic of her visor.
"And you?"
"I am more fucked than you by an entire order of magnitude, old man."
They're all in big trouble," he came back. "Nobody's getting onto that planet."
"Who knows? I wasn't exactly planning anything like this, but I have been thinking around the problem."
"Get moving!"
Scholes suddenly snapped. Then people were shooting at them from ahead. Holston had a glimpse of a pair of figures in some sort of armoured suit, dark plastic plates over shiny grey fabric, presumably the full security detail uniform. They were lumbering forwards, holding rifles awkwardly, and Scholes hauled Lane in front of him.
"Back, or she goes first!" he yelled. "This is your one and only chance to give yourselves up!"
came what might have been Cast's voice from one of the suits.
"Guns down, you turds!"
One of the mutineers shot at him, and then they were all at it. Holston saw both figures stagger. One was knocked flat over onto its back. It was only the frustrated momentum of the bullets, though. There was no sign of penetration, and the fallen security man was already sitting up again, levelling his gun.
"Face plates! Aim for the face!" Scholes shouted. "Still bulletproof, you moron," Lane's taut voice in Holston's ear. "Wait!" the classicist yelled. "Hold it! Hold it!"
And Lane convulsed in Scholes's grip with a howl that was abominably loud in Holston's ear.
"Oh, you twat! I'm half deaf!" she snapped.
The man next to Holston grabbed at his arm to try and rope him in as a second human shield, and the classicist pulled away instinctively. A moment later, the mutineer was on the ground, 3 dark patches spread across his ship suit. It was too quick for Holston to feel any reaction. Another mutineer, a woman, had managed to close with security, and Holston saw a knife flash out. He was in the middle of thinking what a feeble threat that must be when she got the blade into one of them and ripped a gash down the man's arm, the grey material parting stubbornly, armour plate peeling back. The injured security man flailed, and his companion, Cast, turned and shot at her, bullets scattering and ricocheting from his companion's armour.
"Go!"
Scholes was already moving on, hauling Lane behind him.
"Get a door closed between us and them. Get us time. Have that shuttle warmed up and ready."
The last words presumably directed to some other follower already sitting in the bay. Shots followed them, and at least one other mutineer simply dropped, sprawling as they fled. But then Nessel had a heavy door sliding down behind them, hunching over the controls, presumably to try and jam them in some jury-rigged way to delay security that little bit more. Scholes left her to it, but she caught up with the main pack soon after, showing a surprising turn of speed.
"No waiting for stragglers once we're at the shuttle, then."
Holston was seeing his opportunity to make a stand diminishing. He lunged at the mask tongue controls until he was on general broadcast again.
"Listen to me, Scholes, all of you," he started.
One of the mutineers cuffed him across the head, but he bore it.
"I know you think there's some chance if you can get off the ship and head for the terraform project. Probably you've seen the pictures of that spider thing that lives there, and yes, you've got guns. You'll have all the tech from the shuttle. Spiders, no problem, sure. Seriously, though, that satellite will not listen to anything we've got to say. You think we'd be anywhere but that damn planet otherwise? It was within a hair of carving up the whole Gilgamesh, and it blew up a whole load of spy drones that tried to get near. Now, your shuttle's way smaller than the Gil, and it's way clumsier than drones. And I swear, I do not have anything I can say that will work on the insane whatever that's in that satellite. Then think of something, was Scholes' cold response. I am telling you, Holston began, and then they spilled out into the shuttle bay. It was smaller than he had thought, just a single craft there, and he realized he knew nothing about this side of the ship's operations. Was this some special yacht for the commander to gad about in? Or were all the shuttles in their own separate bays? Or what? It was an utter blank to him, not his area, nothing he had needed to know. Please listen, he tried. They made the mistake of showing us what our new home was going to be like, called Nessel's voice. I swear the commander never imagined that anyone might defy his almighty wisdom. You can say what you like, Dr. Mason, but you didn't see it. You didn't see what it was like. We'll take our chances with the spiders and the AI, Scholes agreed. It's not an AI. But he was already being bundled into the shuttle, with Lane right alongside him. He could hear more shooting, but certainly not close enough to change things now. Get the bay doors open. Override the safeties, Scholes ordered. If they're after us, let's see if those suits of theirs can handle vacuum. And even as Lane was muttering, they can, for Holston's ears only, he felt the shuttle's reactor begin to shift them forwards. He was about to leave the Gilgamesh for the first time in 2,000 years. The shuttle cabin was cramped. Half the mutineers had decamped to the hold, where Holston hoped there were belts and straps to secure them. Acceleration was currently telling every loose object, or person, that down was the rear of the ship, and when they reached whatever speed fuel economy dictated was their safe maximum, there would be no effective down at all. Holston and Lane occupied the rearmost two seats of the cabin, where people could keep an eye on them. Scholes himself had the seat next to the pilot, with Nessel and two others sitting beside him at the consoles. Holston's gut lurched under the pressure of the acceleration as they made their getaway. For a moment he thought he was about to lose his stomach contents through the hatch into the hold behind him, but the feeling passed. His bloodstream was still swimming with suspension chamber drugs that fought hard to stabilize his sudden feelings of instability. The first thing Lane said to him once the shuttle got clear was, "Keep the mask. We need a secure channel." Her tightly controlled tones came through the receiver beside Holston's ear. Sure enough, the mutineers were removing their breathing masks. Now they were in an environment they had full control of. One of them reached back for Lane's, and she bucked her head upwards sharply as he grabbed it, so that she ended up wearing the thing as a sort of high-tech bandana covering her mouth. Holston tried the same trick, but just ended up in an awkward pulling match with the man, without achieving anything. "Sod you, then," he was told. "Suffocate if you like." Then the mutineer turned away. Lane leant over quickly, teeth digging into the rubber seal so she could yank his mask down like hers. For a moment she was cheek to cheek with him, eye to eye, and he had a weird feeling of horribly inappropriate intimacy, as though she might kiss him. Then she regained her balance, and the two of them sat there with masks in identical, awkward positions, Holston thinking, how much more like conspirators could we look? The mutineers had other priorities, though. One of the men sat at a console, apparently fighting the Gilgamesh's attempts to override control of the shuttle, whilst Nessel and another woman were giving reports on the systems powering up. After listening a while, Holston realized that they were waiting to see if the Ark ship had any weapons it could bring to bear. They don't even know. Are they wondering if Lane and I will save them by being here? Because if so, they weren't listening to Guyan closely enough before. At last, Lane piped up for all to hear, although her voice echoed hollowly over Holston's mask speaker as well. "The Gilgamesh only has its anti-asteroid array, and that's forwards-facing. Unless you decide to moon the front cameras, there's nothing able to come your way." They regarded her distrustfully, but Nessel's reports seemed to confirm the same. "What would happen if an asteroid was going to hit us in the side?" Holston asked. Lane gave him a look that said eloquently, "And that's what's important right now?" "The odds are vanishingly unlikely. It wasn't resource effective." "To protect the entire human race?" Nessel demanded, more as a jab at Lane than anything else. "The Gil was designed by engineers, not philosophers," Issa Lane shrugged.
or as much as she could with her hands still secured. "Let me free. I need to work."
"You stay right there," Scholes told her. "We're clear now. It's not like they can just turn the gill around and come after us. We'd be halfway across the system before they could build up any speed."
"And how far is this tin box going to get you exactly?" Lane challenged him. "What supplies do you have? How much fuel?"
"Enough. And we always knew this was a one-way trip," the chief mutineer said grimly.
"You won't even get one way," Lane told him.
Immediately, Scholes had his seatbelt undone and fell the short distance towards them, gripping hand over hand along the seatbacks. The movement was fish-like, effortless enough that the man had plainly put in some training time back home.
"If the gill isn't shooting, I'm feeling less and less certain why we need you," he remarked.
"Because it's not the ship you need to worry about. That satellite out there is a killer. It's got a defence laser that will just carve this boat into tiny pieces. The Gilgamesh's array is nothing to that."
"That's why we have the esteemed Dr. Mason," Scholes told her, hovering over her like a cloud.
"You need to let me loose on your systems. You need to give me full access and let me rip the fuck out of your comms panel."
Lane smiled brightly.
"Or we're all dead anyway. Even if it doesn't shoot. Mason, you tell him. Tell him about how Dr. Avrana Kern said hello."
Their acceleration was levelling out, weightlessness replacing the heavy hand that had been pressing Holston back into his seat. After a blank moment, then catching Lane's eye, the classicist nodded animatedly.
"It took over our systems completely. We had absolutely no control. It went through the Gilgamesh's computers in seconds, locked us out. It could have opened all the airlocks, poisoned the air, purged all the suspension chambers."
His voice trailed off. At the time, he had not quite appreciated just what might have happened.
"Who is Dr. Avrana Kern?"
one of the mutineers asked. Holston exchanged looks with Lane.
"She is what's in the satellite. She's one of the things in the satellite, rather. There are the basic computers, and then there's something called Eliza, which maybe it's an AI, a proper AI, or maybe it's just a very well-made computer. And then there's Dr. Avrana Kern, who might also be an AI."
"Or might be what?"
Nessel prompted him.
"Or might just be a stark, raving, mad, psychotic human being left over from the old Empire, who's taken it into her head that keeping us off the planet is the single most important objective in the universe," he managed, looking from face to face.
"Fuck," said someone, almost reverently.
Evidently something in Holston's testimony had sounded convincing.
"Or maybe she'll be having a good day, and she'll just take over the shuttle systems and fly you back to the Gilgamesh," Lane suggested sweetly.
"Ah, on that subject," the pilot broke in, "it looks like our damage to the drone bays has paid off. There's no sign of a remote launch, but wait, Gil is launching a shuttle after us."
Scholes spun himself around and coasted over to see for himself.
"Guyan is really pissed," came Lane's voice sotto voce in Holston's ear. "He's crazy," the classicist replied.
She regarded him impassively, and for a moment he thought she was going to defend the man. But then,
yeah, no, he's crazy, all right.
"Perhaps it's the sort of crazy you need to have got us all the way out here, but it's starting to go off the bad end of the scale."
"They're telling us to cut engines, surrender our weapons, and give up the prisoners," the pilot relayed.
"What makes them think we'd do that, now that we're winning?"
Scholes stated. The look that passed between Lane and Holston was in complete accord that here, in spirit, was Vree Guyan's very double. Then Scholes was hovering above them again, staring down.
"You know that we'll kill you if you try anything," he told Lane.
"I'm trying to keep track of all the ways this venture is likely to kill me, but yes, that's one of them."
She looked up at him without flinching.
"Seriously, I'm more concerned about that satellite. You need to cut us free right now. You need me isolating the ship's systems so that thing can't just walk in and take over."
"Why not just cut the comms altogether?" one of the mutineers asked.
"Good luck on getting Mason to sweet-talk the satellite if we can't transmit and receive," she pointed out acidly. "Feel free to have someone looking over my shoulder at all times. I'll even talk them through what I'm doing.
If we lose power or control for one moment, if I think you're trying to slow us so the other shuttle can catch up with us,"
Scholes started.
"I know, I know."
With a scowl, the chief mutineer produced a knife and severed Lane's bonds, and Holston's too, as an afterthought.
"You sit there," he told the classicist. "Nothing for you to do yet. Once she's done her work, you'll get your chance with the satellite."
Apparently he didn't feel that making overt death threats was necessary to keep Holston in line. Lane, clumsy in the lack of gravity, flailed over to the comms console and belted herself down in the seat next to Nessel.
"Right, what we're after here," she started, and then the language between them got sufficiently technical that Holston failed to follow. It was obvious that the work would take some time, though, both reprogramming and physically cutting connections between comms and the rest of the shuttle's systems. Holston gradually fell asleep. Even as he was dropping off, he felt this was a ridiculous thing to do, considering the constant threat to life and limb, combined with the fact that he had been out of the world for a century or so not so long ago. Suspension and sleep were not quite the same, however, and as the adrenaline now ebbed from his system, it left him feeling hollowed out and bone-weary. A hand on his shoulder woke him up. For a moment, stirred from dreams he could barely recall, he spoke a name from the old world, one a decade dead, even before he embarked on the Gilgamesh. Millennia dead now. Then, Lane? Because he heard a woman's voice. But instead it was Nessel, the mutineer. "Dr. Mason," she said, with that curious respect she seemed to hold for him. "They're ready for you." He undid his seatbelt and allowed them to pass him unceremoniously hand over hand across the ceiling, until Lane could reach out and snag him and drag him into the comms chair. "How far out are we?" he asked her. "It's taken me longer than I'd thought to make sure I cut every single connection to comms. And because our friends here don't trust me and kept getting me to stop in case I was doing something nefarious. We've shielded all the shuttle systems from any outside transmission, though. Nothing is accepting any connection that isn't hardwired into the ship itself, except the comms. And the comms don't interact with the rest of what we've got in here. The most Dr. Avarana Kern can manage now is to take over the comms panel and shout at us. And destroy us with her lasers," Holston pointed out. "Yeah, well, and that. But you better get on with telling her not to right now, because the sats started signalling." Holston felt a shudder go through him. "Show me." It was a familiar message, identifying the satellite as the second Bryn sentry habitat and instructing them to avoid the planet. Just what they'd got when they interrupted the distress beacon the first time. But that time, we'd signalled it, and it hadn't noticed us inbound. This time, we're in a much smaller ship, and it's taking the initiative. Something's still awake over there. He remembered the electronic spectre of Avarana Kern appearing on the screens of the Gilgamesh comms room, her voice translated into their native tongue, a facility with language that neither he nor Lane had felt the need to comment on to the mutineers. Instead, though, he decided to keep matters formal just for now. He readied a message, "May I speak to Eliza?" translated it into Imperial C, and sent it, counting the shortening minutes until a response could be expected. "Let's see who's home," Lane murmured in his ear, peering over his shoulder. The response came back to him, and it was disturbing and reassuring in equal measures. The latter because at least the situation on the satellite was as he remembered. "You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way." "Monkeys! The monkeys are back! They want to take away my world! It's only for me! And my monkeys are not, as they say, as they seem, as much as they claim to be from Earth! I know better! Vermin! They are vermin! Leaving the sinking ship of Earth has sunk, and no word, no word, none!"
The translation came easily. Nessel, poised at his other shoulder, made a baffled noise. "Eliza, we will not interfere with Kern's world. We are a scientific mission come to observe the progress of your experiment. Please confirm permission to land." Holston thought it was worth a try. Waiting for the reply was just as wearing on the nerves as he remembered. "Any idea when we'll be in range of its lasers?" he asked Lane. "Based on Kost's drones, I think we have 4 hours, 19 minutes. Make them count. Permission to approach the planet is denied. Any attempt to do so will be met with lethal force as per scientific devolved powers. Isolation of experimental habitat is paramount. You are respectfully requested to alter your course effective immediately."
"Filthy, crawling vermin coming to infect my monkeys will not talk to me. It has been so long, so long, Eliza. Why will they not speak? Why will they not call to me? My monkeys are silent, so silent, and all I have to talk to is you, and all you are is my broken reflection."
"Eliza, I would like to speak to your sister Avarana," Holston sent immediately. aware of time falling away, their limited stock of seconds dropping through the glass.
"Brace yourselves," Lane warned. "If we didn't get this right, we might be about to lose everything, possibly including life support."
The voice that spoke through the comms panel, without anyone giving it permission, was sticking to Imperial C at that moment, though to Holston its haughty tones were unmistakable. The content was little more than a more aggressive demand that they alter their course. "Dr. Curran," Holston sent, "we are here to observe your great experiment. We will not alter anything on the planet. But surely some manner of observation is permitted. Your experiment has been running for a very long period of time. Surely it should have come to fruition by now. Can we assist you? Perhaps, if we gather data, you may be able to put it to use." In truth, he had no certain idea what Kern's experiment was, though by now he had formed some theories, and he was simply bouncing off what he had gleaned from Kern's own stream of consciousness thoughts, transmitted along with Eliza's sober words.
"You lie,"
came the reply, and his heart sank.
"Do you think I cannot hear the traffic in this system? You are fugitives, criminals, vermin amongst vermin. Already the vessel pursuing you has asked me to disable your craft so that they may bring you to justice."
Holston stared at the words, his mind working furiously. For a moment there he had been negotiating with Kern in good faith, as though he was actually a mutineer himself. He had almost forgotten his status as hostage. His hands hovered, ready to send the next signal.
"Why don't you do just that?"
Something cold pressed into his ear. His eyes flicked sideways to catch Nessel's hard expression.
"Don't even think it," she told him, "because if this ship gets stopped, you and the engineer won't live to get rescued."
"Shoot a gun in here and you're likely to punch a hole straight through the hull," Lane said tightly.
"Then don't give us an excuse."
Nessel nodded at the console.
"You might be the expert, Dr. Mason, but don't think I'm not catching most of this."
"Typical that now I find an able student," Holston thought despairingly. "So what do you want me to say?" he demanded. "You heard what I heard then, that she knows what we are. She's receiving all the transmissions from the Gilgamesh and the other shuttle."
"Tell her about the moon colony," Skulls snapped. "Tell her what they wanted us to do. Whatever we're talking to now has been in a satellite smaller than this shuttle since the end of the old empire. You're looking for sympathy?" Lane demanded.
"Dr. Curran, we are human beings, like you," Holston sent, wondering how true that latter part could possibly be. "You could have destroyed the Gilgamesh, and you did not. I understand how important your experiment is to you," another lie, "but please, we are human beings. I am a hostage on this vessel. I am a scholar like you. If you do as you say, they will kill me." The words passed into cold, dead Imperial Sea, like a treatise, as though Holston Mason was already a figure long consigned to history, to be debated over by academics of a latter age. The gaps between message and response were ever shorter as they closed with the planet.
"You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way."
"They are not my responsibility. So heavy. A whole planet is mine. They must not interfere with the experiment. Must proceed. Or what was it all for? Nothing if the monkeys do not speak to me. And my monkeys are all that's left of the human now. These vermin come. These vermin."
"No," Holston shouted. "Not back to Eliza!"
Startling the mutineers.
"What's going on?"
Skulls demanded.
"Nessel?
We've dropped back a step or something?"
Holston sat back numbly, his mind quite blank. Suddenly, Skulls was speaking in his ear.
"Is that it, then? You're out of ideas?"
In tones crammed with dangerous subtext.
"Wait,"
Holston said, but for a perilous moment his mind remained completely empty. He had nothing. Then he had something.
"Lane, do we have the drone footage?"
"Ah."
Lane scrabbled and clawed her way over to another console, fighting for space with the mutineer already seated there.
"Cast's recording?"
Yes, I have it.
"Get it onto the comms panel."
"Are you sure? Only..."
"Please, Lane." Circumventing the comms isolation without opening the ship up to contamination was a surprisingly complex process. But Lane and one of the mutineers set up a second isolated drop box with the data and then patched it into the comms system. Holston imagined the invisible influence of Dr. Kern flooding down the new connection, only to find just another dead end.
"Dr. Avrana Kern," he read in his next message, "I think you should reconsider the need of your experimental world for an observer. When our ship passed your world last, a remote camera captured some images from down there. I think you need to see this. It was a gamble, a terrible game to play with whatever deranged fragments of Kern still inhabited the satellite, but there was a gun to his head. And besides, he could not deny a certain measure of academic curiosity. How will you react?" He sent the message and the file, guessing that Kern's recent exposure to the Gilgamesh's systems would allow her to decode the data. Bare minutes later, there was an incomprehensible transmission from the satellite, very little more than white noise. And then, "Please hold for further instructions. Please hold for further instructions."
"What have you done with my monkeys? What have you done with my monkeys?"
And then nothing. A complete cessation of transmission from the satellite, leaving those in the shuttle to fiercely debate what Holston had done and what he might have achieved. Chapter 3.6 Dulce et Decorum Est. Great Nest has no strict hierarchy. By human standards, in fact, spider society would appear something like functional anarchy. Social standing is everything, and it is won by contribution. Those peer groups whose warriors win battles, whose scholars make discoveries, who have the most elegant dancers, eloquent storytellers, or skilled crafters, these garner invisible status that brings them admirers, gifts, favours, greater swarms of sycophantic males to serve as their workforce, petitioners seeking to add their talents to the group's existing pool. Theirs is a fluid society, where a capable female can manage a remarkable amount of social mobility. Or, in their own minds, their culture is a complex web of connections respun every morning. One key reason this all works is that the middling, unpleasant labour is undertaken by males, who otherwise have no particular right to claim sanctuary within the nest at all if they lack a purpose or a patroness. The hard labour, forestry, agriculture and the like, is mostly undertaken by the domesticated ant colonies that the Great Nest spiders have manipulated into working with them. After all, the ants work by nature. They have no inclination or capacity to consider the wider philosophy of life, and so such opportunity would be wasted on them. From the point of view of the ant colonies, they prosper as best they can, given the peculiarly artificial environment they find themselves enmeshed in. Their colonies have no real concept of what is pulling their strings, or how their industry has been hijacked to serve Great Nest. It all works seamlessly. Portia's is a society now pulled taut to breaking point. The fact of the encroaching ant column demands sacrifices, and there is no chain of command to determine who must make them and for whose benefit. If the situation becomes much worse, then Great Nest will start fraying apart, fragmenting into smaller fugitive units and leaving only a memory of the high point of spider culture. Alternatively, some great leader might arise and take control of all for the common good, and later, if human examples can be valid guidelines, for the personal good. But either way, the Great Nest that Portia knows would cease to be. It would not be the first lost metropolis. In its ceaseless march across the continent, the ant colony has obliterated 100 separate, distinct and unique cultures that the world will never know again, exterminating individuals and overwriting ways of life. It is no more than any conquering horde has ever done in pursuit of its manifest destiny. Portia's military exploits have won some esteem for her peer group, but Bianca is currently their greatest asset, one of the Nest's most admired and maverick scholars. She has improved the lives of her species in a dozen separate ways, for she has a mind that can see answers to problems others did not even realize were holding them back. She is also a recluse, wanting little more than to get on with her experiments, a common trait for those driven to build on their inherited understandings, which suits Portia's peers well, as otherwise Bianca might decide that she was owed rather more of the group's good fortune. However, when she sends a messenger, her peers come running. Should Bianca suddenly feel unappreciated, she would have her pick of the peer groups of Great Nest to join. Bianca is not within Great Nest proper. True science demands a certain seclusion, if only so that its more unexpected results can be safely contained. Portia's people are, by ancestry, born problem-solvers, and given to varying their approach until something succeeds. When dealing with volatile chemicals, this can have drawbacks. Bianca's current laboratory, Portia discovers, is well within the territory of one of the local ants' nests. Approaching the mound along a trail marked out for the ants to avoid, she feels herself reluctant, pausing often, sometimes lifting her forelegs and displaying her fangs without intending to. The old association between ants and conflict is hard to shake. The chamber she finds Bianca in would have been dug by the ants themselves, before being cordoned from their nest by the application of colony-specific scents. Such measures have been attempted in the past to ward a settlement from attack by the encroaching super-colony, but never successfully. The ants always find a way, and fire does not care about pheromones. Silk coats the walls of the chamber, and a complex distillery of webbing hangs from the ceiling, providing the mixing vessels of Bianca's alchemy. A side chamber houses a pen of some manner of livestock, perhaps part of the experiment, perhaps simply convenient sustenance. Bianca presides over the whole enterprise from up on the ceiling, her many eyes keeping track of everything, signalling to her underlings with palps and sudden stamping motions when her direction is required. Some light falls in from the entryway above, but Bianca is above the routines of night and day, and has cultured luminescent glands from beetle larvae to glitter amid the weave of her walls like ersatz constellations. Portia lets herself down into the chamber, aware that part of the floor is also open, giving onto the ant colony below. Through the thinnest skein of silk, she can see the constant, random bustle of those insects going about their business. Yes, they work tirelessly, if unknowingly, for Great Nest's continued prosperity. But if Portia cut through that membrane and entered their domain, then she would meet the same fate the ants reserve for all intruders, unless she had some chemical countermeasure to preserve her. She greets Bianca with a flurry of palps to renew their acquaintance. The exchange contains a precisely calculated summary of their relative social standings, referencing their mutual peers, their differing expertise, and the esteem that Bianca is held in. The alchemist's reply is perfunctory without being discourteous. Asking Portia to wait, she turns her main eyes on the busy laboratory below them, checking that matters in hand can be left without her close attention for a few minutes. Portia gives the activity below a second glance, and is shocked. "Your assistants are male." "Indeed," Bianca agrees, with a stance that suggests this topic is not a new one.
"I would have thought they would prove insufficient for the complexity of such work," Portia essays.
"A common misunderstanding. If well coached and born with the pertinent understandings, then they're quite able to deal with the more routine tasks. I did once employ females, but that results in so much jostling for status and having to defend my preeminence. Too much measuring of legs against each other and me to get the work done. So I settled on this solution."
"But surely they must be constantly trying to court you," Portia replies perplexedly. "After all, what else did males actually want out of life?"
"You've spent too long in the peer houses of the idle," Bianca reproaches her. "I choose my assistants for their dedication to the work, and if I do accept their reproductive material from time to time, it's only to preserve the new understandings we come up with here. After all, if they know it, and I know it, the chances are good that any offspring should inherit that understanding as well."
Portia's discomfort with this line of reasoning is evident in her shifting stance, the rapid movement of her palps.
"But males do not..."
"That males can transmit to their offspring knowledge that they learn during their lives is an established fact, as far as I'm concerned."
Bianca stamped harder to impose her words over Portia's.
"The belief that they can only pass on their mother's understandings is without foundation. Be glad for our peer group that I at least comprehend this. I tried to choose mates who hatched from our own creche, as they're more likely to already possess worthwhile understandings to pass on. And the cumulative effect is to compound and enrich our stock overall. I believe this will become common practice before either of us pass on. When I have time, I will start trading on the understanding of it to those few in other peer groups who are likely to appreciate this logic."
"Assuming either of us is granted so much time," Portia tells her forcefully.
"I will not be remaining in Great Nest long, sister. How can I help you?"
"Yes,
You were at Seven Trees. Tell me of it. Portia is surprised that Bianca knows even that much of Portia's comings and goings. She gives a creditable report, focusing primarily on matters military, the tactics used by the defenders, the weapons of the enemy. Bianca listens carefully, committing the salient details to memory. There are many at Great Nest who believe that we cannot survive, Bianca tells her when she is done. No peer group wishes to attract general scorn by being the first to abandon us, but it will happen. When one has gone, once that gap has been bridged, there will be a general rush to leave. We will destroy ourselves and lose all we have built. It seems likely, Portia agrees. I was at Temple earlier. Even the priestess seemed distracted. Bianca huddles against the ceiling for a moment in a posture of disquiet. It is said that the message is contaminated, that there are other messengers. I have spoken to a priestess who said that she felt a new message within the crystal at the wrong time and without meaning, just a jumble of random vibrations. I have no explanation for that, but it is concerning. Perhaps that message is meant for the ants. Portia is staring down at the scuttling insects below. The sense image of a jumble of random vibrations seems apposite. You are not the first to suggest it, Bianca tells her. Thankfully, my own thoughts on message and messenger are just that, my own, and they do not prevent me from working towards the salvation of our nest. Come with me. I have researched a new weapon, and I need your assistance in deploying it. Portia feels a sudden hope for the first time in many days. If any mind can find a way forward, it is Bianca's. She follows the alchemist to the animal pens, seeing within them an unruly throng of ant-sized beetles, 20 centimetres at most. They are a dark red in coloration, and most remarkable for their antennae, which spread out into a disc of fine fronds like circular fans. I have seen these before, Portia says uncertainly, with hesitant movements. Great confronter of our enemies as you are, it seems likely, Bianca confirmed. They are a species of unusual habits. My assistants have gone into the colony below, at some risk to themselves, to find them. They live amongst the ants, and yet remain unmolested. They even eat the ants' larvae. My assistants' reports indicate that the ants themselves are persuaded to feed these creatures. Portia waits. Any communication from her at this juncture would be futile. Bianca has this entire encounter already planned out, point by point, to a successful conclusion. I need you to gather capable and trusted warriors, perhaps 24, Bianca instructs her. You will be courageous. You will test my new weapon. And if it fails, you are likely to die. I need you to confront the colony marching against us. I need you to walk right into the heart of it. Infiltrating an ant colony is no longer just a case of taking some heads and stolen scent glands. The supercolony has developed its defences. A blind chemical arms race run against the spider's ingenuity. The ants now use the chemical equivalent of shifting ciphers that change over time and in different detachments of the sprawling colony. And Portia's kin have been unable to keep up. The chemical weapons the spiders use to disrupt and confuse their enemies are short-lived and barely an annoyance in the face of the sheer scale of the enemy. The increased security of the colony has had a catastrophic impact on a number of other species. Ant nests are ecosystems in their own right, and many species live in uneasy communion with them. Some, like the aphids, provide services, and the ants actively cultivate them. Others are parasitic, mites, bugs, beetles, even small spiders, all of them adapted to steal from the ants' table or to consume their hosts. The majority of such species are gone from the supercolony now. In adapting to defend against the external enemy, the increased chemical encryption used by the ants has also unmasked and eliminated dozens of unwelcome guests within the ants' domain. A very few, however, have managed to survive by ingenuity and superior adaptation. Of these, the porcid beetles, Bianca's current area of study, are the most successful. The porcids have dwelt within ant nests for millions of years, utilizing various means to lull their unwitting hosts into accepting them. Now the nanovirus has been working with them, and although they are not as intelligent as Portia, they still have a certain cunning, and the ability to work together and utilize their versatile pheromonal toolkit with considerable insight. Each individual Porcid has a suite of chemicals to manipulate the ants around it. The individual ants, sightless and living in a world entirely built on smell and touch, can be fooled thus. The Porcid chemicals artfully create an illusory world for them, guiding their hallucinations to induce suborned units of the ant colony to do their bidding. It is fortunate for Portia and her people that the Porcids have not yet quite reached a level of intellect that would allow them to look beyond their current existence as a self-serving fifth column amongst the ants. It is easy to envisage an alternate history where the advancing ant colony became merely the myriad-bodied puppet of hidden beetle overlords. The changing chemical codes of the colony provide a constant challenge to the Porcids, and individual beetles exchange chemicals continuously to update one another with the most efficient keys for unlocking and rewriting the ants' programming. However, the simple feat of living undetected amongst the ants is left to the Porcids' secret weapon, a refinement of their ancestral scent that Bianca has detected and become fascinated by. Portia has listened carefully as Bianca sets out her plan. The scheme seems somewhere in between dangerous and suicidal. It calls for her and her cohorts to seek out the ant column and ambush it, to walk straight into it past the multitude of sentries as though they were not there. Portia is already considering the possibilities. An attack from above, dropping from the branches or from a scaffolding of webbing, plunging into that advancing torrent of insect bodies. Bianca, of course, has already thought this part through. They will find the column when it is halted for the night in a vast fortress made of the bodies of its soldiers. "I've developed something new," Bianca explains. "Armour for you. But you will only be able to don it when you're about to make your attack." "Armour strong enough to ward off the ants?" Portia is justifiably doubtful. There are too many weak points on a spider's body. There are too many joints that the ants can seize upon. "Nothing so crude. Bianca always did like keeping her secrets. These Porcids, these beetles, they can walk through the ant colonies like wind. So will you." Portia's uncertainty communicates itself through the anxious twitching of her palps. "And I will kill them then? As many as I can? Will that be enough?" Bianca's stance says otherwise. "I had considered it, but even you, sister, could not stop them in such a way, I fear. There are just too many. Even if my protection kept you safe for that long, you could kill ants all day and all night, and still there would be more. You would not keep their army away from Great Nest." "Then what?" Portia demands. "There is a new weapon. If it works." Bianca stamps out her annoyance. "There is no way of testing it but to use it. It works on these little colonies here, but the invaders are different, more complex, less vulnerable. You will simply have to hope that I am correct. You understand what I am asking of you. For our sisterhood, for our home." Portia considers the fall of seven trees, the flames, the ravenous horde of insects, the shriveling bodies of those who were too slow or too conscientious to escape. Fear is a universal emotion, and she feels it keenly, desperately wanting to flee that image, never to have to face the ants again. Stronger than fear are the bonds of community, of kinship, of loyalty to her peer group and her people. All those generations of reinforcement, through the success of those ancestors most inspired by the virus to cooperate with their own kind, now come to the fore. There comes a time when someone must do what must be done. Portia is a warrior trained and indoctrinated from an early age, so that now, in this time of need, she will be willing to give up her life for the survival of the greater entity. "When?" she asks Bianca. "Sooner is better. Gather your chosen. Be ready to leave Great Nest in the morning. For tonight the city is yours. You have laid eggs?" Portia answers in the affirmative. She has no clutch within her ready for a male's attentions, but she has laid several in the past. Her heritage, genetic and learned, will be preserved if Great Nest itself is. In the grander scheme of things, that means she will have won. That night, Portia seeks out other warriors, veteran females she knows she can rely on. Many are from her own peer group, but not all. There are others she has fought alongside, whom she has sometimes fought against in displays of dominance, whom she respects, and who respect her. Each one she approaches cautiously, feeling her way, telegraphing her intent, paying out Bianca's plan length by length until she is sure of them. Some refuse. Either they are not persuaded by the plan, or they lack the requisite degree of courage, which is, after all, near total fearlessness, a devotion to duty almost as blind as that of the ants themselves. Soon enough, Portia has her followers, though, each one then taking to the high roads of Great Nest to make the most